Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
Welcome to Journey Church. My name is Jamie. I'm one of the pastors here. We're thrilled to have you with us this morning. We're in a sermon series called Sabbath and Serving. We spent the last couple weeks talking about rest and the significance of rest, and so these 2 weeks we're going to talk about serving. Now, last week, if you were with us, you heard me unpack a little bit that in the early days of our church, we had run into problems with space. We didn't have enough space for people coming on Sunday to gather in the service. Well, we are having some of those problems again. And so we started talking about, well, you know, of course, how do we help alleviate that and help serve you well? But along with that, the ongoing conversation, how do we continue to serve our community well? How do we love well? And so we thought, let's go back to what we had done in the early days. And again, if you want to hear kind of the long story, just go back to the podcast from last week. But the long story short of that is we organize our church in small group communities called villages, and we're asking our villages every 4 to 6 weeks to get on a rotation and not come to the Sunday gathering at least once a month, or again, once every 6 weeks. And instead of coming here, would they be intentional and maybe serve together on a Saturday morning, and then on Sunday actually have a Sabbath experience? It might be as families, it might still be as a village, but how can we get in the rhythm of making sure that serving is a part of our lives? Because here's the thing. The Sunday experience is important and significant. I hope that when you come on a Sunday, you're walking in and you interact with people and you see people and there's this moment of community, this interaction. But it's hard to have, you know, those of you who are dropping kids or if you're kind of running late or you're taking off early, it's hard to have deep-seated conversations. Maybe you get a few of those in. So another aspect of a Sunday morning gathering is you come and there's a posture of sitting before the Word and just going, God, teach me, remind me, you know, well, let me understand more about you. Let me enter deeper into the mystery. Another aspect of a Sunday morning is an attitude of worship. It's one of the reasons we use music. Music is such a way of carrying us into a place of focus and recognizing who God is. All of these things have great value. But if you bank your life on this kind of a Sunday experience, I can promise you eventually this experience, there will be other values that dominate. This will go by the wayside, and this won't be here. This is a liturgy. This is a spiritual practice, being obedient to gather with other believers. But there have to be other liturgies in our life. There have to be other disciplines, other spiritual practices. And one of those practices that's really significant is serving. And I'll tell you what, I kind of get the general principle of why it's important, but could you boil that down to something? Yeah, we're selfish people. So here's the thing about serving. If we don't have some kind of spiritual practice, ongoing practice of serving people, here's the tendency, to look through the lens of how will this benefit me? And I'm telling you, even when you're in a place of serving, the ego is so strong. The flesh is so strong. Just try this. The next time you realize you're serving someone, you're meeting them at the point of need, just see how many like backup thoughts are queued up going, well, you know, there's a benefit to this if I do. I promise the way your brain works, the way my brain works, like it just queues up all these, well, it does seem a little bit like a waste of time, but maybe I'll meet somebody. It could be a networking deal. Well, you know I should have, but you know, like there's always these other things queued up on why it might be a good idea. Jesus in his teaching is always going after the heart and saying, will you serve just because I've asked you to? And so, of course, Jesus does such a wonderful job of telling stories, and there's a story, it's a story you've probably heard if you've grown up in the church, but it's such a great story. I'm like, I just can't get around this story. And the front part of it is really fun for me because I love the interaction. Whenever Jesus asks a question, by the way, it's not usually for his benefit. When Jesus asks a question, it's not like he's like, oh, just, oh, I'm dying to hear what this guy's going to say. I've been just waiting for this issue to be resolved. And Jesus asks so many wonderful questions, unlike typically with us. And Jesus is so good as a teacher. If I'm out somewhere and I run into somebody, we're having coffee, and somebody has a question, and especially if they're looking for advice or direction, I teach. That's part of what I do for a living. So they asked me a question. I'm like, oh, I got this idea. I got five things queued up, and if I could give them this illustration, putting it up on a tee, like when they ask me a question, I'm like, oh yeah, I will give you all this advice. Oh, it's really hard for me to go, well, let me ask you a question. It's really hard, but it's such an important way to guide and mentor people, because the greatest discovery is self-discovery. If I just spoon feed you all the answers and you just take my thing for it, you don't own it. It's somebody else's, and eventually it has to become yours. Now, obviously, there's something about being taught and being trained and carrying an element of that. I acknowledge that. But it's one of the reasons I try to, as much as I possible, keep putting questions out back to you, because questions agitate. They force us to get into our heart and check in and go, well, do I believe this? And do I think this? And how do I feel about this? Jesus, of course, is the master. So let's go to the story. Probably, again, a story you're familiar with, but I'll try to unpack it from a couple different angles. This is Luke chapter 10, verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up, by the way. On one occasion, an expert in the law. This is the moment. Do you have any experts in your life? Every now and then I ask you this question. So it's that guy, just so you know. He stands up, and I'm sure there's like a voice inflection thing and everything. He stands up, and we get his motive right here, to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said, well, there are five things. If you do 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you meet it with all your heart, you've inherited eternal life. No, my bad, that's not what it says. Jesus does not respond that way. He does not oversimplify it, which, by the way, is a tendency for post-enlightenment thinkers, which is us. There's a real tendency for us to go into our heads, to concentrate on beliefs, doctrine, dogma, and when people ask us questions, go, well, as long as you mentally assent to a few of these abstract thoughts, you'll inherit eternal life. By the way, there's a tendency for us to start up in the head place, the belief center. That wasn't always the way with humanity. That is a post-enlightenment thing. We should think through rational thought and logic, and that's how we should answer our question. Jesus does not start there. He goes immediately to a story. He wants to engage the heart. Why? Because Jesus is always saying, if you want to inherit eternal life, it's about a way of being, not a way of thinking. Thinking is a part of it. Doing is an aspect of it. But ultimately, it is a posture of humility before God. Important for us to remember. And I'll give you a quote from James K.A. Smith on that a little bit later. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says, well, what is written in the law? How do you read it? Jesus doesn't answer the question. And I just think, just don't miss the irony of this. I'm probably dwelling on it too much. It's just so fun to me. Verse 27, the guy answers. He starts with questions. He's the one doing all the answering. Well, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. This is the centerpiece of Jewish teaching. Verse 28, you have answered correctly. Jesus replied, do this, and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who exactly is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. When he fell into the hands of robbers, they stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Quick context for this story. When it says a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, literally he was going down. Jerusalem is up in the mountains. Jericho is down, like, Jericho's a picture like an oasis with palm trees, and it was this beautiful. So, but it was about a 17-mile drive, and people who lived in Jericho, Jericho was like an amazing place to live, because if you lived in Jericho, you could get a bigger house for less money. About 17 miles south of Jerusalem. Right there. And however, nobody really thought about the road situation a whole lot, and so there's a great deal of traffic on Columbia. Anyway, Herod hired all these people to create this other town, a bedroom community, and after he was done, he just laid them off, 40,000 people. Not really great for morale or for the social construct or for the economy. So what do these 40,000 people do? A bunch of them are like, they don't have a job, so they start robbing them. They got to take care of their families. So now this road becomes known as the Way of Blood. So imagine your morning commute is known as the Way of Blood. And so when people traveled, often they would travel in packs or they would travel certain times of day. You know, there are certain things you did to try and be careful. Well, for whatever reason, this guy's out traveling alone. He's robbed. He's beaten. He's left half for dead, half dead. Verse 31, a priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So to a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. Now, again, framework, the priest would be, in our world, it might be a Catholic priest, or it might be a Protestant pastor or an elder. It was someone these were the ones who were responsible for sacrifice. They were in great positions of leadership. The Levite would be considered like a deacon. This would be like the worship leader or village leader or somebody who serves with the kids. But people who understood the process of ministry and actually helped teach it for a living. They're the ones who are talking about how important it is to serve one another. So Jesus is absolutely pointing out the hypocrisy of the moment. They go by and they do nothing. Verse 33, but a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. In order for us to just have a frame of reference here for Samaritan, I'm going to use some words so that we have some understanding of when Jesus was telling the story, what was happening. The story would be like someone reading today and going, the pastors and the worship leaders and the children's leaders all walked by the man in need, but there was a homosexual who walked down the road and he saw a need and met it. There was a Muslim freedom fighter who was a follower of Allah, and he walked down the road, saw the need, and met it. There was a southern white male. Who saw the man and met his need. There was a transvestite who saw the man and met his need. There was an urban African American who saw the man and met his need. There was an Orthodox Jew who saw the man and met his need. There was a Fox News analyst who saw the man and met his need. There was a Huffington Post journalist who saw the man and met his need. There was an entitled Hollywood actor who saw the man and met his need. So Jesus was telling a story, and he was going after the primary prejudice of the day. So if I didn't pick the place you are most tempted to be prejudiced, then you pick another one. But when you hear the story, you have to think in terms of, where does your prejudice go? Because Jesus is going after that. He's creating quickly a great contrast. The person you thought might do the job, they didn't. We often think we're the good guys, and we often look the other way. And often the people who you would say are the outcasts, the people who really need to be told they're wrong, who need their lifestyle straightened out, that would absolutely be the position of the Jews with the Samaritans. They made their own place of worship. They didn't really worship in the right way. They were half-breeds. They abandoned the purity of their race. So the person that, in whatever person in your world you think needs to be straightened out, somebody needs a talking to, someone who needs to be corrected, Jesus is using that person in this story as the personification of the one who is kind. This person, whether or not they had their doctrine right or dogma right, actually displayed the love that God is talking about. That was Jesus setting up here in the story. Verse 34, the Samaritan, or fill in the gaps, went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. And he looks at the very religious man, and he says, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? If we had time to just sit in the literary development of this passage, who is my neighbor? A man was walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. And then right at the end, he pulls up, and again, doesn't really answer the question, but asks another question. Which of these do you think was a neighbor? Because I'm telling you, before this story started, the expert of the law would not have said the Samaritan was the neighbor he was supposed to love. The expert in the law replied, and he can't even bring himself to say the name. The one who had mercy on him. And Jesus told him, go and do likewise. Jesus is always subverting. I mean, his teaching is just so amazing. And he's trying to help us in so many ways. His stories are filled with multiple facets. The significance of us serving, the significance of us meeting people in need, the significance of the awkwardness that comes with serving someone who's not like us. And I think sometimes we get in this place where we go, man, I've just been praying. God, I really want to know you. I really want to be close to you. I feel distant from you. I've got doubts about who you are. And could you just show yourself to me? And God's saying, I just keep showing up. If you want to know me, Jesus said this, and this happens throughout the teaching of the New Testament. However you've treated the least of these in your mind, by the way, because who's the least of these? There's nobody least in God's mind. They're all his creation. However you've treated the least of these in your grading system, it's as if you've interacted with me. So the person most annoying in your life, and I went through kind of some hotbed prejudice issues, but the person you might be prejudiced might be just, like you might really, Southern Baptists might annoy you. Men might annoy you. Middle schoolers might annoy you. Like, whatever the person is that most annoys you, that is most difficult to get along with, the person that's most challenging to love, go and do likewise. Show mercy on that person. He's disrupting. He's trying to get through our prejudice along with saying, would you please serve? So the longing in your heart to know God, the opportunity to know God might be right in front of you with the most annoying person in your life. And as you serve that person, as you show mercy on that person, I wonder if your heart might change. I wonder if in the act of mercy you might actually get to know God. I have these moments, I'm like you. I want to know you. I want to feel close to you. I want to feel connected. I told this story, I think it was in Lovewell, I can't remember, one of the books I wrote. But I told this story where I went away, did a little Sabbath, like a three-day thing in a cabin, and I just had this moment, and I was like, God, I just like, could you walk up? Could you just like walk out of the woods and I got a rocking chair right next to me. I know I'll probably be a little freaked out, but you're God. You can like calm my nerves. But I just want, man, like this, I want to just see you. I know that's probably like maybe not enough faith or maybe it's a mustard. I feel like I got like pumpkin seed size. Like I got a little more than usual. Like I'm ready. Rocking. No joke, I promise you this happened. I'm doing this. A raccoon walks out of the woods. True. I'm like, oh, look at that. It's a cute raccoon. He's kind of fat. And he walks up, and I had a little campfire, and he's sniffing around the campfire. And I'm like, oh, man, that's cool. I've never been really that close to a raccoon. And he comes over, and he's waddling. And the edge of I'm pretty close to the edge. There's like two steps up to the porch. And he starts making his way like over to the porch. And he puts one paw that looks like a hand, puts it up on the front porch like that. I'm like, whoa. I've been sitting really still at this point. I'm like, this thing probably has rabies. And he sniffs, and I promise you this is true. He's looking at the rocking chair, and he's like this. And I'm like, that's saved for Jesus. So he takes another step coming up on the porch. I got a little freaked. Now I am freaked out. I'm like, ah! And he takes off into the woods. I was like, oh my heavens. Sheesh. God, I'm asking for you, and I get a raccoon. This was Narnia, and I totally missed the moment. He was going to come and sit on the rocking chair and talk to me. I'll never know. My faith shrunk quickly. I think we all long to be with God. We want to be in his presence. We want to feel close to him. We want to connect with him. I think this is one of those stories where God's saying, if you want to see me, see me in the person that's hurting around you. I broke this down into four things. There's four specific things a Samaritan does, and I think it's a great picture of, like, when it comes to meeting the needs of people, serving them, what does it look like? In this story, there's these kind of four sequential things. Number one, he bound up his wounds. When you meet somebody, sometimes there's this tendency, like, to go, man, like, this person's in need, and you're like, man, I know what'll solve your problem. You just need Jesus. You need to find Jesus. You need to give your life to him. Well, the problem in this case, like, let's say the Samaritan, let's say he was a modern-day kind of Western believer, and he has this compulsion, like, man, this guy just needs to hear about Jesus. And he walks up, he's like, hey, man, you need to hear about Jesus. Like, this is not the starting place for that conversation. The man is bleeding on the road. You know, D.L. Moody is famous for saying, you got to give him a hungry man a sandwich before you can ever give him the gospel. And it's that picture. Sometimes we might even go, I think I know what you need, but that person might not know what they need. So start by meeting them at their point of need. In this case, this man was bleeding. He needed to be tended. He needed healing. He needed someone to give attention to his wounds. And this is where the Samaritan really begins to set himself apart. Not only is he attentive to the man's needs, but he gets down in it. Like, you get the picture. It's dirty. He's bloody. That sounds like a good song. We'll listen to it later. He gets dirty. He gets bloody. And look, our default is to isolate or disassociate in such a way that our world is fine and other people's is a problem. It's easy for us to kind of be in our own fantasy. It's easy, and the Houston thing is a great example. You might be watching on TV and being like, man, that's too bad for them. That's too bad. And that was, like, they got 10 seconds of your sympathy. That might be the extent of it. And you might go, well, my life is so busy. And this is not judgment. I'm not saying you should give 15 or 30 or 5 hours. We all have to listen to the Spirit in regards to the needs we're aware of. But I'm giving you that as an example of sometimes we just isolate into our own world and we don't see the needs. We don't see them. And they may be close, they may be far, but we don't see them. Isolation leads to Pearl Harbor. Those valuable battleships we have sitting in paradise may one day be left bombed and burning because we thought we could just take care of ourselves and no one else. But the reality, if you've lived a little life, you know this is true, is you will get sucker punched. It will happen. In some kind of way. Perhaps the person you thought you trusted most turns their back on you, walks away. Whatever the thing is, life is going to happen to you and it's going to bring pain. Who will be there for you when you're lying on the road bleeding? We want to be loved. We want someone to take care of us at our point of need. And I think over the 12 years of journey, there are multiple people in here. There were some moments I was lying on the ground bleeding, and there are multiple people in here who came and found me on the ground and cared for me. I can't imagine what life would have been like without someone seeing my needs. And so those people are around, you're that person. Maybe not today, but you will be. The world exists in perpetual chaos with no predictable outcomes. In the midst of this uncertainty, God does not tell you what he's going to do, which is what we typically ask for. Instead, he reveals to you who he is. And often he reveals to you who he is through the life of another person. That was Oswald Chambers. Most often, this revelation comes through the love of another. So think about it like this. You are queued up, you're poised to be the revelation of God for someone else today. September 2017, right now, if you know God, the Spirit of God alive in you, working through you, you are queued up, you're poised, you have a gift, or God's going to have something to say through you. Right now, you're prepared to be the revelation of God to another human being. This afternoon, someone in this room will reveal God. You'll reveal his love to someone in need. It'll happen. I know enough about the church that I know who we are. The question is, do we have eyes to see? Are we aware? Are we glazed over? Are we giving attention to the opportunity? So number one, he bound up his wounds. Number two, he put him on his ride. He actually took time to care for him. When I was in high school, this is 1986 or 87, I was, maybe 86, I was going for my, it was the summer, and I was going for my driver's ed test, and my best friend signed us up for 7:30 in the morning. I don't know why, it's because he was an adult at 16, and he you know, was like, he went to work longer that day, I don't know, and so we did our thing for the summer. We just ride our bikes, and this is 87, so I had my Walkman with me. Millennials, that's, there was a... You push the eject button, it went, and you put a cassette tape in there, and you closed it, and you had headphones, and you plugged them in, and that was, anyway. And I was riding my bike, riding my 10-speed, and, you know, in those days, you didn't hold on to the handlebars, you know, I was just, what's up, I'm just riding my bike. That's my walk, man. It's probably air supply. And, and I'm going down the, just driving down the road. I'm at 7:30 in the morning. It's the last day of driver's ed. I'm supposed to take the test. And they just laid down these cinders along the road because they were going to prepare to pave the road. Really bulky, grindy, painful cinders. I'm riding my bike, throwing my hands on the handlebars, and my wheel catches one of those and just flips like perpendicular, like just total stop. But my body didn't stop. Poof, so I shot like across the handlebars, and I was like, wah! I'd hit so hard, I'd split my chin open here. There were holes right here, and in those days, our shorts were like up to here. So, along with the holes in the tops of my knees, my thighs looked like someone took a chainsaw to them. And I stood up, and you, those of you who've had the moment like when that accident and your body's in shock, and you're like, wah, wah, wah. I'm standing on the side of the road, like. Wah. And some guy pulls up in his Cadillac. And the 80s people, it was burgundy velvet. That plush stuff in the back, you know? He's like, are you, and, you know, I think he did have a power window. He rolls it down, and he's like, are you okay? I'm like, ha, 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 ha. And so he gets out, and he's like, you know what, just go ahead and get in the back. I'll put your bike in the trunk. And this man, he picked me up. He can't, I'm in a back horse, like, trying to pull the blood in my hands not to get over his plush velvet. And I never saw the person since. He just drove me to my driver's ed test, and, you know, I got bandaged by the nurse, and I passed. So some of you have seen me driving. You're surprised. This man put him on his ride. He inconvenienced himself. And, I think there's a prayer for us as a church. Oh, Lord, may we never be comfortable religious people who insulate our lives from the needs of others. See, it's not simply enough to know the path to salvation. It must be expressed and extended. Number three, he cared for him. Mother Teresa is famous for saying the greatest disease in the West, she's speaking of us, by the way, is not tuberculosis or leprosy. It's being unwanted, unloved, and uncared for. I'm giving you examples of Houston people in great physical need, the example of myself. But the truth of the matter is there are people all around us right now who are bleeding out. Some of you walked in here today, and when I said unwanted, unloved, uncared for, you went, oh, I know that one, and I know that one, and I know that one too. And this might be you today. I don't feel wanted. I don't feel wanted by marriage. I don't feel wanted in my family, in my job. I don't feel wanted at the marketplace. And there's nothing that'd be more meaningful than someone to come and actually care for you. For someone to give you more than a passing how are you, but to look you in the eye, to check in on your heart. We in the West can become so hurried. This is why we spent the first 2 weeks talking about rest and Sabbath. That we don't see the hurt. That we're just unaware of the pain. And I'm encouraging us to be a church that serves people. Yes, that has a spiritual practice of serving, and sometimes it's putting it on our calendar and serving that way, but to also have a spirit of serving that we are aware that when something's off with someone, we have enough to pick it up. And go, hey, are you okay? It's one of the reasons we have these small groups called villages here, because, again, if this Sunday experience is your only experience, you're only experiencing a really small portion of who Journey is. Our deep desire is to care for you and to give you space to care for others in community. in the mess of relationships. Number four, the Samaritan paid for him. And this is a principle that comes through Scripture over and over again. Love always costs something. Love always costs. If you're married, you know love costs. There are things you give up for your marriage partner. If you're a parent, love costs. There are times, how many of you, is, especially if you're kind of in that age where your kids are kind of in that middle range, you know, like probably just out of elementary or late elementary, and you're looking on Facebook and Instagram and people are posting pictures of like going on vacations with other couples and you're like, oh, that must be nice. And you know, it looks like all these adults have friends and they hang out together all the time. And you're like, I can't barely get up in the morning and survive with my children. Like, I don't know, how do I make time for that French? And you might have this moment where there's even this longing for the soul and you're going, but love costs something. As much as I wish I could develop that friendship a little bit more, I am pouring this into my children who are currently in need. This man gave up his time, his schedule, was interrupted. His possessions, his clothes, his comfort, he walked while the man rode. His emotional energy, and his money. And I'm not sure there's a verse in the Bible that sums this up any clearer than this. 1 John 3:17, but whoever has the world's goods, you have some kind of resource, and beholds his brother in need, and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Why does this man stop? What is it about him that's different? See, the Good Samaritan did not become good in the instant. It was who he was. It flowed from somewhere. Kevin did this wonderful thing for our leadership team. And I've asked him, he's going to come and do some of this next week, about what, there's always a presenting thing, but what's going on underneath? See, we all have a need to form inwardly. James K. A. Smith says this, we are in many ways embodied actors rather than merely thinking things. Sometimes we start just with what we think, but what makes us who we are, the kind of people we are, is what we love. See, you can argue and debate with people all you want about abstract thoughts and doctrinal positions, but what do you love? If a biographer showed up to your house and was like, hey, we're going to do a biography on your life, and you're like, oh, really? Okay. They're like, yeah, let's start with what do you love? And you're like, well, I love margaritas, and I mean, I love my family, and I love football, and yeah. What do you give your time to? What do you love? Because that's what makes you the kind of person that you are, not what you think, not what you say you think. Not what you say you believe, but what you love. That's the liturgy of your life. Our hearts are oriented primarily by desire, by what we love. And because those desires are shaped and molded by the habit-forming practices in which we participate, it is the rituals and practices that shape our imaginations and how we orient ourselves to the world. This is why I'm trying to remind us of the significance of spiritual practice, discipline, and liturgy of our lives. And might we remember this, that there is, in many ways, a bigger story going on. Jesus wasn't just telling a story as he always did, he modeled it. Remember what I can't remember if I told you this, but the way, yeah, I did. They named that road the Way of Blood. Well, I don't think the irony is lost when you realize that Jesus was the Samaritan that came to rescue us. We were lying, bleeding out, and Jesus came to save us. And he bled on our behalf. He created this thing called the inn, the church. It's meant to be a place for nurturing and healing wounded and broken people. Whether we invite people into our midst or whether we go to them, the mission of the church is clear. 1 John 4:11, dear friends, since God so loved us, we ought to love one another. The question that started this whole thing is, who is my neighbor? Your neighbor, my neighbor, is anyone in need of compassion? Do you have eyes to see, ears to hear? Would you pray with me? Before I pray, would you just go to a place of reflection? Close your eyes, stare at the floor, whatever helps you focus. Is there a neighbor that God has stirred up? Is there a name that's come up to the top while we have been in dialogue on this story? When you hear that phrase, anyone in need of compassion, is there anyone in your life who's in need of compassion? And what would it look like for you to meet that person at their point of need? And if God is laying someone on your heart, would you ask him how you might serve? Father, you're so patient with us. Your kindness never fails. Your goodness swirls about in eternity. Thank you for the way you have met us at our point of need. God, would you remind us of that? That we are broken people being redeemed but in need. And would we respond to you in a posture of humility to actually receive your help? Not try and do everything on our own. And then, God, would you orient our lives in such a way that serving just becomes part of who we are, that we're really good at recognizing, and that we would act from a place of mercy. God, individually, would you guide each one of us how to show compassion, how to break through our prejudice? Church, as the Journey Church, God, show us how to meet the needs of this community and meet the needs of people in crisis. I intercede for those in Houston in particular. God, just the scale of need is so great right now. And I ask that you would reveal yourself to them while they're left with questions, while they're picking up the debris of their life. Would you carry them into a place of what has real meaning? And I ask that in the tragedy of it all, they would just turn to you and find you in deep, meaningful ways. I ask these things. And